Welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson. Tonight we have another special podcast. Last week we gave you the essay entries from our listeners. Tonight we're doing a follow-up with essays from some of our panelists. First of all, we'll start out with Glenn, who will give us an essay on testimony. George will talk about changes in marriage. Tom talks about rules and perfection. Zilpha talks about our place in the Mormon universe. And I talk about faith in God. I hope you enjoy.
I'd like to bear my testimony. I know the church is. I know that Joseph Smith was, and that he had, and that he did, and that sometimes I wish that I could too. I know that President Monson is the president of our church, and that the Liahona was round, and that the sword of Laban was sharp, and that the golden plates were shiny. I know that tradition is perhaps the single most important invisible influence in our beliefs and worldview and the way we live our daily lives. I know that using words like perhaps can create a lot of leeway. I know that apologetics makes me want to scream, and that 2 + 3 = 4. I know the road is narrow and the yoke is easy, and that many are called. I know that we must all endure until... I know that folklore is more than just Paul Bunyan. I know that religious devotion is created and defended and is often more important than kindness or compassion or tact. I know that prideful people have a problem with pride, and I know all about the world. I know that memorats are personal narrative accounts of first-hand experiences with the bizarre and supernatural, that they maintain and validate and justify belief. I know that emotion is powerful and real, and that memory is malleable. I know that human beings are very good at being human everywhere. I know that hope creates conviction. I know that the culture and the gospel are two separate things in many people's minds. I know the rugs where we sweep our dirty laundry. I know that false dichotomies are false. I know that magic is the idea that we can bind invisible powers to our own personal will. I know that when I pray, that I'm speaking, and when I bless, that I'm comforting, and when I fast, that I'm hungry. I know that the priesthood is for all worthy males who are both worthy and male. I know that Dumbo's special feather was black. I know that three patterns give a sense of wholeness and correctness and completion, be they structures of society, concepts of divinity, or simple patterns of speech. I know that people all too easily confuse the symbol for the idea and reify abstraction and cling desperately to the absurd. I know that I'm sarcastic and irreverent and very mostly true to what I feel. I know that my perspective and delivery is often offensive and threatening and repulsive to many who would otherwise be my parents or my wife or my friends. I know that I'm arrogant and opinionated, and I know I could be wrong. I'm thankful for my family and for my friend. I'm thankful that I wasn't born in Africa or in France or to a sexually abusive parent. I'm thankful for my cushy life. I'm thankful for my pain-in-the-neck Japanese mission and for my remarkable accredited BYU education and for the many leaders of the church throughout my life who have set such clear and concrete examples of what I should and should not be. I'm thankful for the story of the atonement and for the promise of redemption, the possibility of repentance, the absolution of divine forgiveness, and the hope of eternal progression. I'm thankful for Jesus' example of love and forgiveness and peace, and that he reproached the Pharisees even more than I do. I'm thankful that he hasn't struck me down with lightning yet. I'm thankful that he taught in parables and didn't care if the prodigal son was really prodigal or if the Good Samaritan was really real. I'm thankful for Noah and the way he squeezed all those animals into the ark and that he saved the flying reindeer. I'm thankful for Jonah's message to the Ninevites and that great fish have such weak and slow digestion and that he could escape and become a real boy. I'm thankful for the Tower of Babel and for Mahanrai and for 16 glowing stones. I'm thankful that Ammon chopped off all those arms. I'm thankful that outer darkness requires a perfect understanding and that even the lowest degree of glory is still a place of everlasting happiness or joy, whichever of those two things is best. I'm thankful that agency is free, that warmth can be Luke, and that I have such a comfortable fence to sit on. I'm thankful that the glory of God is intellectual. Wait. I'm thankful for this church and for the many lessons it has taught me and for the many lessons it will continue to teach me as I pull, by gradual Sundays, the clinging hairs, even the hairs out of my very clinging head, in painful, bloody clumps. And these things I say because I still don't know when to just shut up. Eminem.
The first part of this story has been told and retold countless times. The people in the story may change, but the basic storyline remains the same. The plot goes like this. Mormon boy meets Mormon girl. They date for a short period of time, fall in love, marry, and proceed to raise children within the clutches and teachings of the LDS faith. One day, or perhaps over the course of a year or two, the story takes a twist away from the fairy tale. This twist starts when one of these parents, sometimes the husband, but just as likely the wife, finds themselves in the situation where they no longer believe some of the doctrines and stories learned in childhood and often repeated into adulthood. She may find, for instance, that to her adult understanding, there is not significant evidence to support the idea that the Book of Mormon is a genuine historical record. Or he may find that perhaps the first vision, or the bringing forth of the Book of Mormon, occurred following a process differently than normally taught. These elements of true history are often called minor tidbits or insignificant details. However, to this person, they don't seem so minor. Also, when many minor tidbits are combined together, they start to loom large. This person may also find themselves troubled by the LDS Church's involvement in political matters that they disagree with, or with the financial dealings of the church real estate or business ventures. Whatever the reason, they find themselves in what has been very adequately described as a crisis of faith. For a time, the person may try to keep this fact hidden from their spouse. The mantra of go slow has softened many a blow. But the reality is the believing spouse will eventually be made aware of the struggles, and more particularly, the fact that their non-believing spouse has in some way changed, and sometimes significantly so. At this point, not only is the person in crisis, but often the marriage, the family, and the extended family as well. Your story may vary, but this is a common theme within the LDS Church that plays itself out in many homes today. I now want to relate this basic storyline to my own life. It is a story that, while it begins in a dark and bleak place, has become for me one of faith, hope, and optimism. It is also told while in the middle of the journey. Much of the tale is yet to unfold. In my situation, my personal life story of the last few years follows the plot line I've described fairly closely. We'll pick up the story in 2004. I've traveled the road of finding a bride, marrying early, having children, and then working through the journey of being a husband, father, and a full-believing LDS church member. I served diligently in the scouting program for many years, and eventually I had the opportunity to serve as Elders Quorum president and as Young Men's president. I've worked hard at becoming a very good member of the LDS Church. The dark twist in my journey begins with the deep desire to be the very best early morning seminary teacher I could be. I found myself teaching a stellar class of very bright, smart, and motivated students, including two of my own children. They would ask questions that caused the class and me to further investigate and look for deeper understanding to gospel topics. This group of LDS high schoolers attended a school where they were the minority religion, but also the minority Christian religion. 80% of their classmates were well-studied in the Bible, in the life of Christ, and very involved in their evangelical churches. These classmates asked questions and demanded answers to well-thought-out issues about the LDS faith and our relationship to Jesus Christ. Much of our time in seminary involved diving into doctrines and trying to deeply understand the text. The problem we constantly ran into was that the correlated material left much to be desired, and my personal journey to learn and understand was born. As I sought additional church materials that would aid in my understanding of the New Testament, cracks began to appear in some of the basic doctrines as I had been taught. I would also turn to the Internet for deeper understandings of biblical events. For a busy yet sincere seminary teacher, the Internet became a treasure trove of information that aided in understanding Christ and his meaning to these students and to me. Studying the New Testament started this ball rolling, followed by a year teaching the Book of Mormon and then a year of church history. In total, I made it through 5 years of teaching early morning seminary, but the third year studying the Doctrine and Covenants was the year of my crisis of faith. The journey into my crisis was complete when I found that there were communities on the Internet of people just like me. I wasn't alone in my doubts and concerns. There could be a path forward, and I found solace in the fact that others had traveled this road before me. I was elated, relieved, and grateful to find others who shared my concerns. I was so excited to share this information with my wife. My excitement was not shared by her believing heart. What had started as a personal crisis of faith began to move in and cause a marriage crisis as well. For the past 2 years, we have talked, argued, cried, and struggled with these minor tidbits, which have caused me so much anguish, but seem to roll off her like water off a duck. How can she accept these things as truths when it is so clear? But her struggle with me is just as painful. How could her husband of 25 years, who had been so strong, no longer believe? Her faith and knowledge is built on experiences just as mine is. Does her faith no longer count? And it continued along a downward spiral. The kids could tell there were problems. Extended family could as well. Things were not as they were, and something had changed. The marriage was in trouble, and both of us were preparing emotionally to step away. Eventually, we made the decision to seek professional advice, to see a therapist, a marriage counselor. Perhaps we could find someone who could help us with the tools and techniques to either fix what was broken or give us guidance on how to go our separate ways. However, what we have found has surprised us. First, it ends up that our marriage was already kind of broken. Things were not well, and we had been masking them. Once we started delving into what was causing the problem, our religious issues were just one piece of a complicated puzzle. Second, we've discovered that a 25-year investment in marriage is not something you should easily walk away from. Studies show that if a couple separates, they often carry similar problems into the next relationship. Why not try and fix them in a current relationship? Then if the marriage still needs to dissolve, you can, but at least you know that you've tried to fix yourself and you learned something new about yourself taking it into your next relationship. This path of trying to fix our current relationship is the path that we have decided to follow. What we have found is that a crisis that was brought on by a religious disagreement may be the best thing that has ever happened for our marriage and for our family. We have a new sense of hope. We are working to right the things that were wrong and have a shared sense of spirituality between us that will transcend anything that Mormonism can bring. The level of optimism and connecting feels like it did 25 years ago, but now we bring so much more shared knowledge and life experience. We are no longer two young kids falling in love and starting a life into the unknown. We now bring a much larger set of life with us. She's different. I'm different. We are dating and falling in love. The future looks so much better than it did. In my opinion, many marriages that have a common belief structure find that many aspects of what makes them a strong couple and individuals is a mask of underlying issues. How many assumptions about the other person do you make just because a common faith structure is shared? These assumptions may be valid, but there are many other factors and aspects of a marriage than a shared religious value. So if you find yourself in a marriage that is struggling, you are not alone, and there are many resources that are available to you. It is possible to start again, to actually make a relationship that isn't just fixed, but profoundly different and better than anything you have known. For me, this has been life-affirming and provides hope. My wife and I have an opportunity to build a common spiritual base to our relationship that is not based on doctrines or dogmas, but true values that we define for ourselves. We are discovering each other and encouraging each other and loving each other in ways that I don't think we've ever experienced before. While a shared and common religion might not be in our future, a shared but broken religion reliance in our past has been the catalyst for a very bright tomorrow. I hope what I have shared with you may assist you in some way. Please, if you're struggling in your marriage, or even if you think your marriage is healthy, my parting words of advice would be to seek outside professional advice.
I've never reconsidered my membership in the LDS Church until about 3 years ago. I've always thought of myself very lucky and to be very blessed to be part of the, quote, one and only true church upon the face of the earth. I always wondered what I had done in the pre-existence to be so lucky. And I assumed that I must have been a valiant soldier back then, and sometimes even caught myself wondering if I fought alongside Angel Gabriel. I was unknowingly developing a kind of unintentional sense of superiority. I didn't consider myself smug or an arrogant person growing up in the church, and in fact, I often felt bad for those who weren't members of the church. I remember on multiple occasions shaking my head in disappointment at those who weren't members of the church. But then again, I knew that our missionary program, expansive as it is, would find them eventually in this life or in the next. So while I felt bad for most of them, I knew that if they truly wanted the truth, they would eventually get it someday. Although having the feeling of being blessed and having the truth in my life didn't mean I was immune to difficulties in my experience growing up in the church. The church, unintentionally or not, puts constant pressure on its members of never being good enough. Perfection is the goal. We must become like Christ. The importance of strict obedience is reiterated all too often. This church is widely known for telling its members what they should and shouldn't be doing. I think most leaders in the church don't actually realize the many negative side effects of instituting constant pressure of consistent and strict obedience required of its members. I'll admit that it's important to emphasize rules and why they're important, but the constant reminder that your eternal salvation depends on your level of obedience can be very disheartening to some. My life growing up in the church wasn't all that bad, though. Actually, most of my youth and some of my adulthood was rather positive in the church. I really do enjoy the ability of being able to provide service and assistance to those in need, and the church allows many opportunities for service. I also remember meeting many wonderful people that I would have never met if it weren't for my current church responsibilities at the time, my mission being one of those. My mission is riddled with positive and negative experiences, as I'm sure most missions are, but on a whole, I look back at my mission with regret and remorse. I wish I didn't, but I do. I know that most people naturally remember the negative rather than the positive, but my negative experiences have weighed heavily on me for a long time, and some have forever changed me. When I entered adulthood and I began to enter local church leadership callings, here's where I will say that I started to find myself enjoying many of the responsibilities in the church. I was able to serve many people that I wouldn't have normally been able to serve. I was even able to perform a baptism for someone that I was home teaching at the time. I slowly began to find my place and began to love and appreciate the church more and more. But it wasn't until late 2007, when I was currently serving on the High Council, that I began to allow my many hidden doubts in the church to finally take a hold on me. It was then I finally faced my doubts and decided to finally confront them all head on. So I entered apologetics and began to study church history frantically. After almost a year of ingesting lots of previously unknown Mormonism and its history, I came upon one particular night where I just couldn't sleep. I had been reading and studying as usual, but for some reason, something happened that night when I tried to go to sleep. One particular question just kept haunting me over and over again, and I couldn't for the life of me elude it, no matter how hard I tried. Could I have possibly been wrong all this time? Admitting you're wrong is one of the toughest things a person can do. In fact, some people never can admit that they're wrong. All of us want to be right, but as difficult as it is to admit, more times than not, we are wrong, and most of us aren't even aware of it. Some of the fear of the possibility of being wrong will prevent us from allowing ourselves to look at ourselves objectively. It's much easier to notice when someone else is wrong. A lot of us have seen people drive the wrong way down a one-way street. I've even seen some people literally drive for miles before they realize that they've been driving the wrong way. Even with evidence like signs and noticing the obvious oncoming traffic that clearly isn't in the right lane, still isn't enough to make some people aware that they are the ones in the wrong. Some will even criticize the other cars rather than realize that it might be them that are going the wrong way. But really, how much of us are really truly much different? In our current situations or problems, have we looked at all of the available evidence or statistics objectively, evaluating both the positive and the negative? Or do we only look for the evidence that supports our previously made conclusions? It is common and natural for most of us to unintentionally look for evidence to support what we are already committed to. It's normal to want evidence to support our decisions because it's uncomfortable to admit to being wrong. I'm always amazed at how many people fall into a multi-level marketing scheme when strong evidence shows that they very rarely produce the amount of money promised to for those that sign in. And to add insult to injury, these, quote, pyramid schemes will even ask for money up front for one reason or another, but yet still, numerous people still sign up. They only listen to how much money they, quote, could earn. Most people won't even allow themselves to read or listen to anything that might threaten their hopes or their desires. And even when the news is riddled with several Ponzi schemes, they'll still find ways to say to themselves, well, this company isn't like any of those. I was wrong about the church. I came to the realization that it wasn't what I thought and believed it was. I realized that it wasn't what it claims to be, and it shook me to my very core. With this realization, I came to realize several things. One was that I now understand the importance of looking at things objectively. I also realize how important and difficult it is to admit to being wrong. And this was one thing that I really didn't want to be wrong about. And here I am, admitting that I was wrong, feeling very duped. I turned visually into that jackass, you know, like on the Roadrunner cartoons. I still have a deep soft spot for the church, and I still actively attend, but I see things very differently than I previously did. Now I approach most things with the realization that I might be wrong. I'm so very appreciative of science and the scientific method. Evidence is what we base all of our understandings on. I was wrong, and no doubt I will be wrong again in the future. But at least I'm a little more aware now, and I walk a little more carefully, rather than running in a direction without noticing the upcoming cliff.
I was 14. I believed everything that I had been taught by my parents and my religion. I read at least a chapter in the scriptures every day. Well, pretty much every day. I wrote in my journal. I really thought that everyday life should be like the scriptures. The church's main message to me seemed to be that I was special. I was chosen by God to be born into the covenant and in the chosen generation that would welcome Jesus back in his glory. I was assured that as part of this rising generation, I had a special mission. Sure, I had my faults, but I believed that the Savior would help me overcome them. I knew that in spite of my weaknesses, God would make me strong. I felt like through my faith, I could literally move mountains if necessary. That's what I had been taught over and over again, and I believed it. And why not? Things seemed to happen when I prayed. Blessings seemed to work. Heavenly Father seemed to be guiding my every step. One Christmas, my family took a vacation all the way from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan to Oklahoma. It would be an 18-hour drive one way. We had 7 kids and 2 parents in a van. My dad had built a platform in the back where tired kids could nap and our luggage could still fit underneath. I remember bringing along canned food just in case. You never knew when a can of beans might come in handy. We never needed the can that I had brought, but I probably would have preferred those to the raw peanuts we unwittingly bought at a grocery store for a snack. And instead of stopping for fast food, we bought bread and bologna and mayonnaise from a grocery store. My sandwich had way too much mayonnaise, but I ate it anyway. I attribute that sandwich to the fact that my stomach still turns a little bit when I think about eating a bologna sandwich. Along the trip on our way to Oklahoma, I got very sick very quickly. I was burning up with a fever. I was delirious, talking about my best friend trying to catch hamburgers that were floating around in the air. It might have been a mixture of being hot from being under layers of blankets, the raw peanuts, and the extra mayo. But it was suggested that I should get a priesthood blessing. So we pulled over the van to the side of the road, and my dad gave me a priesthood blessing. I believed that God would heal me. And almost immediately after the blessing, the fever went away and I felt much better. Of course, in retrospect, it probably didn't hurt that I took off the blankets and got some fresh air. My mom took advantage of the fact that we were all trapped in a small space with few entertainment options to read articles from the Ensign. We also sang along to popular church music tapes. My poor 16-year-old brother spent about half the trip at my mom's feet in what we called the pit. It was often the case that whenever he was put in the mix of the rest of us, things turned explosive and fights broke out. When he was removed, things were calm. Of course, it was usually the little ones that were poking him and egging him on that caused the problems, but he got the pit nevertheless. Since Independence and Far West Missouri were not too far out of our way, we stopped at a few church historical sites, including Adamondayaman. There wasn't a lot to see there. I tried to feel the spirit, though, thinking about the second coming of Jesus and Adam to this place that was once the Garden of Eden. We had a hymn book with us, and we sang together Adamondayaman. I was reading in the Doctrine and Covenants as we drove around Adamondayaman. I was using the spirit to guide me as I flipped through the pages, and I happened to land on Doctrine and Covenants, section 84, verses 96 to 103. It was where Joseph wrote the words to a hymn that he said would be sung at the time that Adam and Jesus would return. I loved music, and I had already written a few original songs, and so was immediately interested in the idea of a new song dictated by the power of God and to be sung at such an important occasion. As I read the words, though, I thought, these words don't really sound like a song. At best, it sounds like a strained poem with no rhymes and awkward meter. Maybe it would be sung in tongues? The pure Adamic language? Still, I was intrigued and felt a stirring in my heart that I interpreted to mean that God might call on me to write the music for the song the saints would sing when they greeted Adam and Christ back to begin the millennium. I really wanted that to be true, and I relished the possibility. Well, my family continued on to Oklahoma and spent a pleasant Christmas with our relatives there. Upon returning home, I took out my Doctrine and Covenants and looked at the words of the song again. I still couldn't see how I could ever write music to them that would make the words into a hymn that people could actually sing. But I felt that when the time was right, Heavenly Father would help me. I was waiting for further light and knowledge from Him. I hoped that the music would come to me when the time was right, in other words, when the second coming was just about to happen. But before I could write that song, I started to sing a different song. In my late 20s, I began to get interested in church history, and some doubts about my place in the world began to arise. Trying to forestall the inevitable, I purposefully stopped reading any church history except for church manuals, and tried to stop myself from thinking anything that was contrary to church teachings for nearly a year. I remembered the Doctrine and Covenants song. I was seeing so many signs that pointed to Joseph Smith not being a prophet that I thought that if his clunky poem could actually become a hymn, well then at least that was something. The time for me to work on the music for the Millennium Song was either then or never, since subconsciously I knew that very soon my doubts would lead me out of the church completely. So I took the DNC to my piano keyboard and started to hash out music for the hymn. The music actually came very quickly and was much easier than I had previously thought it would be, but I knew that the music was no proof of Joseph as a prophet or of God. I was suddenly aware that it was I who had produced the music, just as it had been my 14-year-old self that had wanted to be special to God so badly that I had convinced myself that he had a very special role for me to play in the millennium. Anyway, the hymn now exists, awkward as it still may be. My singing voice is quite weak, and so I've decided not to sing this hymn for you. You should thank me. But I see it as evidence that people don't really need supernatural powers to be able to accomplish seemingly impossible things. And I think I'll hang on to it, just in case. You never know when a millennial hymn might come in handy.
As a young man growing up a Mormon, I always considered myself to be a Christian. It wasn't anything that was at question. It was something that people would bring up from time to time, accusing Mormons of not being Christians, but it was something that I didn't understand at all. I always just figured we were. We had Jesus as the central part. If you went to the temple square, you'd see the big statue of Jesus. Jesus was part of everything. He was in the hymns. He was in the Book of Mormon. That was the key event. Now, many have pointed out before that your concept of God is probably more shaped by the male authority figures you have in your life than anything from the scriptures. But to me, the God of Mormonism was always a God who is stern, who is mean, and who is overly legalistic. It was never a personality that I could identify with. It was somebody to be feared, somebody to be avoided, and somebody to be petitioned from time to time to get what you needed. But it was not somebody that I envisioned with love or with caring, or that I thought was an overarching presence of love. I guess that's probably not true. But the concept of love was one of a stern love, a love that wanted me to achieve more than I had or more than I could, that wasn't satisfied with what I was. The Mormon relationship with Jesus was also a little strange. There are some key factors about the relationship with Jesus that oftentimes get brushed under the rug. I think in the zeal for Mormons to protect the idea that they are Christians, and for evangelicals and their ilk to weigh in and suggest that Mormons aren't Christians at all, some of the key facts get sidelined. It is quite interesting that Mormons do not pray to Jesus. They don't worship Jesus. And they tend to eschew the trappings of Jesus and his worship. They don't use crosses. They don't use the little fishes or any of the other symbols that normally unite the Christian world in their belief. Jesus is, in the Mormon paradigm, our eldest brother. People believe that Jesus is God, but sometimes his usness, as opposed to his godness, is emphasized. Now, let me be clear. This is done right along with all the other ideas and thoughts and feelings about Jesus being the great Jehovah and the God of the Old Testament, and the one who we close every prayer in the name of, that Jesus does become central. But many people have pointed out that entire sacrament meetings can go by without a single mention of his name. So for me, as my faith in Mormonism started to slip, the relationship with Jesus was a little rocky. I believed, as I started to wonder if the Mormon church was not for me, that I would end up in some liberal Christian church, that I would end up holding on to the belief in Jesus, because it was so central to my identity as a religious person. But I found that as I was exposed more to higher criticism and lower criticism, that as I began to really look at the Bible, that that belief didn't stick. And I believe some of that was because of the strange sort of view that I had of Jesus. I found that as my faith started to slip and I began studying a lot of Mormonism, I realized I didn't quite understand what the rest of the world was talking about. And I got a systematic theology book and a history of the Christian church, and I read through them, and it was an eye-opening experience. There were many things that I didn't understand, and there were many terms that I clearly had a different definition than the Christian world did, that I might read a passage and say, yes, yes, that's what Mormons believe too, but realized that as I looked deeper, that we had redefined the word, that we'd gone off on a separate line or on a different tangent, and that we seemed to be saying the same thing, but really we were saying things that were entirely different. Over time, slowly, my faith began to dwindle in both Mormonism and in religion altogether. I probably started to lose my faith in the supernatural before I lost my faith in any of the specifics, that I lost my faith in God before I lost my faith in Joseph Smith. But during that whole time, I figured that Jesus would hold on to something. And as I went through, I conceptualized those things differently every time. I started out with my stern view of God and of Jesus in an auxiliary role. As I looked at the Christian teachings and other teachings across the world, as a matter of fact, I noticed that one thing that was key for religion and for religion survival, and that's the religion had to deal with a great deal of ambiguity in its writings or in its teachings. For example, if God tells you to both sell and buy a sword, you can do either one and feel justified. Christianity's staying power might just be that it can mold itself to fit the fashions of the time. It is hard to believe that the same religion and same belief and same Bible fueled the early ascetics, the Crusaders, and the Mormons and the Jehovah's Witnesses all the same. Things could not be more different. The books that they rely on allowed for the sort of ambiguous interpretation for us to reflect our own values and our own cultures and have them come right back to us. Take today in the United States and how many see in ancient Christian writings a reflection of American jingoism. But all that aside, I saw the greatest central message of the New Testament was the message of redemption. Central to the message of the New Testament was that Christ was the Redeemer and could redeem and save mankind and all people from their sins. That pattern has been taken and moved in so many different ways. Modern American Christians see that as simply a get-out-of-jail-free card. It seems to me the more I studied Christianity, the more I realized that all paths either lead to universalism or Calvinism. And Christianity, as it descends down that universalist path, always risks becoming irrelevant. And as I read through the different Christian beliefs and Christian philosophies, I tried to conceptualize those things different. And at one point, I ended up with my last conceptualization of Jesus, one that probably most Christians would consider to be a heresy. We read in the New Testament that Jesus suffered the sins and pains of all mankind. But as I read the New Testament, I began to believe that it wasn't just the punishment that Jesus suffered, but the sin itself. And to suffer the sin itself, one would have to suffer both of what leads up to the sin and the consequence of the sin. So if Jesus is suffering from the sin, he's suffering from the desire to commit the sin. In that sense, Jesus descended below all mankind by understanding and feeling and partaking of the very worst of mankind. The only way that Jesus could suffer the sins of, say, a child molester was if Jesus himself understood the desire that child molesters feel. Although that idea might seem blasphemous, that was the last idea that gave me hope. Because we are left in a world where we really don't understand things anymore. More and more, it seems that people's environments and their chemistry describe their behaviors. My current job takes me into jails all across the country, and I've come in contact with many different inmates. One thing that becomes apparent when working with inmates in the jails is most of these guys had no chance. Fetal alcohol syndrome, low IQs, child abuse, broken families. All of these things contribute to the factors that got them there. It's very rare to find somebody languishing in a county jail who had a life of privilege and had went to a good school. That most of our behaviors seem to be greatly determined by our environment. The other day, my wife and I were watching a documentary in which a little girl was born with a rare birth defect. She was missing a key chemical. This made her so she trusted everybody. The lack of the chemical made her a completely loving and trusting person. If one thinks about it for a minute, one can see the obvious problems of a little girl who has no distrust and no fear of any human being. But this was a chemical that was missing. This was something that we would see key to our own personalities, but it was something that was hardwired into her system. The next time you feel distrust, it's probably from a chemical surge. The next time you feel lust or happiness or anything, it comes largely from the machine that is us. Now, I'm not suggesting there's no such thing as free will, but as we look and we see the picture that's more complicated, we are left with a harder time to judge. Returning again to Jesus Christ, if Jesus merely suffers for our sins, then what good is that? Why don't we all just suffer for our sins? Why don't we all just pay our own penalty? I can't think of anything that'd be more just. As a matter of fact, I would sign up for it in a heartbeat. I have committed my sins and I own them. No one else should have to suffer for them. But if what Jesus really suffered was the pangs of desire, was the desire for sin, was being a sinner, that Jesus, being the one perfect person, became, in essence, the most vile of all people, so that he, and only he alone, could understand. In the end, I found this portrait of Jesus to be moving, but I could not grasp onto it. I found that it was foreign and alien to most of the Christian world. And in the end, I realized that, did it really matter? Sure, if some guy up there could understand and have complete empathy with every human being, that would be a wonderful thing. But it doesn't help us down here today. We're left to deal with the ones in prison. We're left to deal with those with chemical imbalances. We're left to deal with our own imperfections. And we're left to deal with each other. Ultimately, my lack of religion is a religion in and of itself, in that we must take care of one another. We must act as if there's nothing else. If we put all of our hope into something that may or may not be, we ultimately risk wasting our time. But even if there is a God, even if there is a Jesus who has suffered below everybody, can it still help just to help out ourselves?